And then they get tax breaks for being here. And they take the profits that they earn off of us and they send them overseas and they keep them there so that they don't even have to pay taxes at the federal level.
Right.
Yeah, it's estimated now that I think this past year, something like $2 trillion has been held overseas by the top 500 corporations.
Oh, yeah.
That should be paid back into the American economy in taxes.
Yeah.
That we just aren't getting. And yeah.
Right. Well, and that's one of the things that we're trying to push here with our city council right now is the idea of a living wage tax, where, you know, let's actually start taxing wealthy people and big, huge corporations so that we can make 15 something that's reasonable for even, you know, small little local mom and pop shops that might have a really small margin,
right.
Maybe really can't afford to pay their employees $15 an hour. Unfortunately, the political will is just not there for it. I think that's been made pretty clear by our city council.
But I think by the numbers, and Nicholas Caleb getting almost 20%, I think with nobody knowing him, and that's unheard of.
Yeah.
And I think that is an indication that people are fed up. I think it's time for 15 now. And I think it's time for more than that. But I think that people are really getting behind this. And we're actually out of time here. The folks from Prison Pipeline are going to want to put their show on. But this is such an important thing, you guys. Thank you so much for coming down to the studio.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Real quick, how can people get involved? Everybody wants to help. How can they help?
Well, you know, I mean, like Jess Spear said, you can always go to the 15now.org website and donate. They're trying to set up a national branch right now that can help out all the different locations outside of Seattle. And then we've got our own site, 15nowpdx.org. We've got, you know, volunteer contact forms. There's a donation page there that you can donate directly to 15nowpdx. And then Socialist Alternative.
Yeah, and you can go to socialistalternative.org, sign up to become a member. We just started a new branch here. We've been here for about 3 months now. So you can contact us through the website and just come to our meetings and help us with the fight.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for coming down here and putting out the good word. You guys are fighting an amazing fight. I'm going to pitch in and help.
Awesome.
And right. I believe that everybody listening right now is going to also. Thank you, everyone. This has been Labor Radio, and I hope you have a wonderful evening wherever you're at.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
June 20th, 2014, Stories from the Streets is a groundbreaking celebration at Pioneer Square in Portland, Oregon, dedicated to exploring the life of hip-hop in the Pacific Northwest. Our mission is to raise awareness on the positive influences and lifelong benefits that hip-hop culture has had on our homeless youth and our community. All proceeds and donations from Stories from the Streets will directly benefit New Avenues for Youth Nonprofit Artist Mentorship Project. There will be graffiti, breakdancing, DJing, and rapping. Artists include Soul Miner, The Resistance, Black Butterfly, Ancient Soul, Mike Crenshaw, Lucky I Am of Living Legends, and DJ Andy Sparks. More information can be found at kboot.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. June 20th from 12 to 9 p.m. in Pioneer Square in downtown Portland.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Guy. In 2011, Troy Davis was put to death by the state of Georgia despite overwhelming evidence pointing to his innocence. His execution was protested by hundreds of thousands of people across the globe, and Troy became the iconic face for the campaign to end the death penalty. In April 2014, Jen Marlowe, co-author of I Am Troy Davis, and Troy's sister Kimberly Davis spoke in Portland about Troy's case. Tonight we'll hear their discussion and readings from the book I Am Troy Davis. The event was co-sponsored by Amnesty International Portland Group 48, Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, and Kol Shalom Community for Humanistic Judaism. First, we'll hear from Troy's sister, Kimberly Davis.
People ask me, you know, how do I continue to go around and talk about my brother's case? How do I continue, you know, not to be sad? Like my brother said, that it was nothing for us to be sad about because we fought a good fight. And he told us, he said that if the state of Georgia did succeed in executing him, they would only take his physical body because he had already given his soul to God a long time ago. We were always a family that prayed together. We were a family that prayed together and a family that stayed together. And when you have that foundation to stand on, you know that you can continue to hold your head up, continue to be strong, and you want to stand for what is right, and that's what I'm doing. Continuing to go around and spread the news about my brother's case, about the injustice in this case, and I'll go wherever I can go to let people know that the death penalty is wrong and we're going to end this state by state. It can't be done overnight, but our voices are powerful. If we get out and let our voices be heard, Troy Davis could have been any one of you sitting in here. It could be any one of your family members. My brother fought a good fight. My sister fought a good fight. My mother fought a good fight. And we're going to continue to fight that fight. Thank you.
Next, we'll hear from Jen Marlowe, co-author of I Am Troy Davis. She speaks about how she became interested in Troy's case.
I got involved in the case because I saw Martina speak on Democracy Now! Right after Troy survived his first execution date, which was in 2007, which was one of four execution dates. The fourth one was when they ultimately got him, but he survived three previous execution dates. And when I heard Martina speak about her double struggle, how she was fighting for her own life, having been diagnosed with terminal breast cancer in 2001, at that time given 6 months to live, that was 2001. Now we're in 2007 when I'm hearing Martina speak, and she's talking about fighting for her own life so that she could raise her son and continue to fight for her brother's life. And I sat up and I paid attention because you could not hear Martina speak without sitting up and paying attention. And I wanted to know more about this brother whose innocence she was fighting so hard to prove. And dug up some information online, the Amnesty International report that was published in February 2007 called Where is the Justice for Me? And this report laid it all out, some of the things that you heard Kim just mention now. The fact that there was no physical evidence that ever linked Troy to the murder of the police officer. The fact that the entire case against Troy was based on eyewitness testimony, yet 7 out of those 9 eyewitnesses later recanted or contradicted their testimony. The fact that one of the remaining 2 witnesses who had not recanted actually was the person who had gone into the police station the day after the murder and said, oh, I can give you the name of who did it, because the police had no idea who did it, and gave them the name Troy Davis. And that new witnesses since came forward and actually implicated that very man as someone who had either confessed the crime to them or that they had seen him pull the trigger. And as I, you know, read all this evidence and my jaw dropped. At that time, I thought that this must be an exceptional travesty of justice. What I didn't realize is that it's actually a very ordinary travesty of justice, and that so many aspects of Troy's case, including the very ones I just detailed, are what make his case emblematic of a broken system. And I want to be clear that I consider the death penalty the sharp edge and the highest stakes consequence of a much larger broken criminal justice system, which really is, I would say, a human rights crisis in this country. And I wrote a note to Troy in prison, and that's how it started. He wrote back and forth. We corresponded. We became friends. He introduced me to Martina, and she just happened to mention, well, people tell me I should write a book, but, you know, gosh, I've never, you know, I don't have time to write a book. I need someone to help me to write it with me, and I immediately volunteered. The book came out in this past September, which September 21st is when it was released, which was the 2-year anniversary of when Georgia managed to kill Troy, but Georgia never managed to kill the fight that Troy was fighting and the fight that Martina was fighting. In fact, by Georgia's shameful act of executing Troy, what they ended up doing was mobilizing all of us to fight even stronger, to fight even harder, and to shout even louder in Troy's name.
At each event, local community members were asked to read passages from the book I Am Troy Davis. The first reader is Frank Thompson, who was the superintendent at the Oregon State Penitentiary from 1994 to 1998, and during that time, he oversaw the execution of two men who volunteered to be executed. He is now active in Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty.
The first passage we're going to hear from today is Frank's going to read it. I think you'll understand when you hear the passage why it's so poignant coming from Frank. The passage takes place in 1994. It was soon after Troy arrived on death row. Troy had already lived through executions of a few of his fellow inmates on death row, but when it was Chris Berger's execution, it was very different for Troy because Chris Berger was Troy's closest friend.
Troy had never intended to make friends on death row. But there was something disarming about Chris Berger. Chris was tall, trim, strong, and gave off a tough demeanor, but he showed warmth and affection to his friends. He sketched beautifully with colored pencils, often sending his drawings to his mother, to whom he was devoted. He was older than Troy by more than 10 years, but there was something vulnerable and childlike about him, perhaps stemming from the history of severe childhood abuse. Chris had been only 17 years old when he had participated in the murder of Roger Honeycutt. When his execution date was set for December 7th, 1993, he confessed to Troy how frightened he was. Troy saw the guards parading Chris sadistically in front of the other death row inmates on the evening of December 7th, before leading him to the execution chamber to strap him into the electric chair. Troy sat in his cell, hunched over his bed, waiting for the horrifying moment when the lights would flicker, indicating that a high voltage current of electricity was coursing through Chris's body. Every man on death row twitched in the silent agony when the flickering began at 9:50 p.m. Troy knelt on the hard floor, gripping the steel frame of his bed tightly, and prayed for his friend. Only later did he learn that Chris Berger's last words had been an apology to everyone that he had ever hurt and a plea for forgiveness. One of the guards who had paraded Chris leaned against the bars of Troy's cell. "Hey, Davis," Troy heard the guard say. Troy looked up. "Yeah? How'd you like some fries to go with your burger?" Troy resolved never to become quite so close to anyone else on death row again.
The next reader is Nassim Raqqa, author of The Crying Tree, a book that examines forgiveness and the death penalty in a fictional story that takes place in Oregon.
The passage that Nassim is going to read takes place in 2001. It was shortly after Martina was diagnosed with cancer, shortly after she was given that prognosis of 6 months. And I think you've gotten a little taste already this evening, a little whiff of the fight that is part of the backbone of the Davis family, of every member of the Davis family. And I think you'll see a little more of that in this passage and in Martina's decision that she wasn't just going to accept what she had been told about the amount of time she had left, that she was going to make a very different choice.
It was another bad night of vomiting, retching, and diarrhea. Martina stayed curled up in bed in the morning, listening to the sounds of Mama getting Dewan ready and then everyone leaving the house. In another few weeks, her son would be 7 years old. In another few months, her brother would have spent 10 years on death row. Martina scratched her head, coming away with a clump of hair. She stared at the fistful of hair for a long moment before pushing back the blanket, slowly sitting up in the bed, and pushing her feet into her slippers. She had a child to raise, and a brother to get off death row. It was time to get up. Martina opened the front door. She took one shuffling step and then another, making it as far as the mailbox against which she leaned for support, feeling the warm Georgia sun beat down on her face. Tina, you all right? It was her neighbor from across the street. I'm all right. She let the sun warm her for a few more minutes. She might be dying, but she wasn't dying today. She made her way back into the house and, without fully realizing what she was doing, found herself in the bathroom, rubbing a generous amount of Nair onto her head. When Dewan came home that afternoon, Martina was waiting for him on the couch, wearing her favorite dress and her head fully wrapped in a colorful scarf with an African motif. As he approached to give her a hug, she pulled off the scarf, unveiling a shiny, bald head. Dewan jumped back for a moment, then he wrapped his arms around her and squeezed tightly. It doesn't look bad, Mom. You look really pretty today. She got up the next day and walked a few steps further. Come on, let's walk down the street, her neighbor suggested the day after that. Martina took her hand and they slowly made their way to the corner and then back. When Trevor picked her up to take her to chemo, Martina was fully made up, wearing jewelry and loud Caribbean colors. I might have cancer, she told him when he looked at her quizzically, but cancer doesn't have me. Martina's strength slowly returned. And as her renewed strength lasted, she decided that not only was she not dying today, she also wasn't dying tomorrow. She likely wasn't dying next week, or even next month. She could take a deep breath, relax, and live her life without worrying that every moment might be her last. Perhaps her illness was her creator's way of telling her, I need your attention. There's more that you need to do, and I need you to do it more abundantly. If she wasn't dying today, then she was going to live today.
The last reader is Tony Funches, first vice president of the NAACP Portland chapter, and is active in Partnership for Safety and Justice.
The final reading that Tony is going to do today, I mentioned that Troy had survived three previous execution dates before he was ultimately killed, and it was that first execution date, the one that got me involved in his case, it was 2007. They had just had the day before the slated execution, there was a clemency hearing in front of the Georgia State Board of Pardons and Parole. And you can imagine the tension and the anxiety that the Davis family was experiencing as they were back in the hotel room waiting to hear what the Georgia Board would decide. Would Troy, would his life be spared? Or would the execution proceed the next day as it was scheduled to proceed at 7 p.m.?
July 16th, 2007. An unfamiliar number appeared on Martina's caller ID at 8 p.m. Hello? Martina? Yes. This is the New York Times. How do you feel? How do I feel about what? About Troy's stay. What stay? The parole board gave Troy a 90-day stay of execution. Martina threw the phone down and began to leap around the hotel room. Troy got a stay. Troy got a stay, she screamed. Just then, Mama's cell phone rang. Virginia punched through the numbers as quickly as she could so that she could hear Troy's voice. Hi, Mama. How'd the hearings go? Virginia put her cell phone on speaker so Troy could hear Martina, who was still dancing and shouting ebulliently. You hear that, honey? The family huddled around Virginia's cell phone to hear Troy's reaction. For a moment, there was silence. Then an almost inaudible, thank you, God. Followed by another, thank you, God. This time a little louder. Troy did something he did regularly. Troy prayed. Then he did something he almost never did. Troy began to cry. Two guards led Troy from the death house back to his cell block. Fellow death row inmates lined up at the doors of their cells, extending their arms through the iron bars to grasp Troy's hands as he walked down death row. "Praise God, brother," one man called out to him, tears in his eyes. "Maybe at least one of us will survive this place," another cheered. Troy's friends shoved small items through the bars for him to take back, items that Troy had bequeathed to them the previous day. A bottle of shampoo, some extra stamps, a few envelopes, his belt and shoes. Troy, head high and a new spring in his step, walked into his cell. He heard the familiar clank of the cell door locking behind him. But at that moment, he was not focused on his confinement. He was focused on his life. Georgia had intended to take it from him in less than 24 hours. He and his family and scores of supporters had fought, and they had prevailed.
You know, I very intentionally end with the passage that Tony read because I think it's really important to remind ourselves that we have had and we are continuing to have a lot of triumph in this movement. There's been a lot of, there's been success after success, many of them since Troy was killed. And in fact, I believe because Troy was killed, I believe that this country was so shocked and so outraged at the fact that Georgia felt so comfortable proceeding with executing a man when there was such a mountain of evidence pointing to his innocence that people began to wake up and things began to shift. And that triumph that Tony's passage ended with, I think, is reflected in the fact that in the 2.5 years since Troy was killed, there was a moratorium on the death penalty right here in Oregon. Actually, that was just about 2 months after Troy was killed that the moratorium on executions happened here in Oregon. The death penalty was abolished in Connecticut. And then in Maryland, there's now a moratorium in Washington State. New Hampshire is in the midst of debating right now in New Hampshire State Senate about whether they're going to abolish the death penalty. So we are winning the fight. But having these kinds of spaces for vitally important conversations about the death penalty is one of the reasons why we will continue winning this fight.
If you're just tuning in, this is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. You are listening to an event called I Am Troy Davis, recorded in April. And now we'll hear from Frank Thompson, former superintendent of Oregon State Penitentiary. He spoke during the question and answer session about his decision to move from supporting the death penalty to working with Oregonians for alternatives to the death penalty.
The evidence is coming forward now where there have been numbers of employees who thought it was being weak to admit how bothered they were to have to go through an execution, because you're in uniform, you're strong, you're a good soldier, but you go home and you drink until you ruin your family life. There's a story that you could go on the internet and read about a gentleman in Texas. He was a model correctional professional. But following every execution that he had to participate in, he would go through periods of drunkenness. There's one person who lost control of himself, had a nervous breakdown because of the experiences they had in participating in executions. Now, in Oregon, we have not had a person to have the post-traumatic stress syndromes similar to what I'm describing here, but I do have those who supported me in carrying out those executions said, "Frank, I don't know how the people in Texas go through 144 executions, as many executions as they do. I could not take it." I have a colleague that decided that they could not participate in any more executions. My last comment, and it's sort of pivotal to my having taken the position that once retired, by the way, I'm no softy on crime. Don't get it twisted. I'm a career law enforcement professional. I'm a correctional professional. I believe in justice, but I believe in fair justice. I believe in people being held accountable. I don't believe that government should train decent men and women in the taking of a life of a human being in the name of a public policy that cannot be shown to work. Given all of its weaknesses that we're all so familiar with, I'm a product of the civil rights era. I was for the death penalty a long time. I remember when the three girls in Mississippi were killed, and my family and my community felt like death penalty might have been a just sanction for the people who perpetuated that crime. That was Martin Luther King's assassination. That was John F. Kennedy's assassination. That were murders, heinous murders, that the black community, the community that I came out of, felt like the death penalty probably was an appropriate sanction for these kinds of crimes. But when I got into the position, when I was called upon to lead men and women into this room and take the life of a human being in the name of a policy that I knew in the back of my mind somewhere, that it just wasn't working, it just overwhelmed me with a sense of immorality. And it's more about us and our inactivities and not getting to our legislators and those that we elect and holding them accountable to bring about that kind of repeal activity that will rid, at least here in the state of Oregon, us of the death penalty.
We really wanted to end the evening. We thought it would be most appropriate to end the evening with Troy speaking in his own words. And it's actually Troy's last words. It's the words he spoke when he was strapped on the gurney on September 21st, 2011, in Jackson, Georgia, with three IVs in his arm, ready to pump his body full of lethal poison, one IV to inject a fluid that would paralyze him, the first to numb him, the second to paralyze him, and the third to stop his heart. And these were the words that he chose to go out of this world being left by, and they were recorded. And this was the message that he wanted to leave the world with, and there is a message for all of us in this room. And so I want to end the evening with listening to what Troy wanted us to hear.
Yes. First of all, I'd like to address the Fails family. I'd like to let you all know that despite the situation, I know all of you still are convinced that I'm the person that killed your father, your son, and your brother. But I am innocent. The incidents that happened that night was not my fault. I did not have a gun that night. I did not shoot your family member. But I'm so sorry for your loss. I really am sincere. All that I can ask is that each of you look deeper into this case so that you really can finally see the truth. I ask to my family and friends that you all continue to pray, that you all continue to forgive, continue to fight this fight. For those who are about to take my life, God have mercy on all of you, son. God bless you all.
And now, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Troy Davis, Movement Lessons. The state judicial murder of Troy Davis of Georgia showed both the limits and the successes of the anti-death penalty movement. It seems silly to speak of successes when a man is poisoned to death by judicial decree, but though they were partial, they were successes nonetheless. To attain the support of people like former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, Pope Benedict XVI, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and former FBI Director William Sessions was no small feat. It showed the reach of the movement to procure such support. The movement was also fueled by such revelations as shown by the recantations of people like Antoine Williams, who was one of the state's witnesses. Williams later stated, quote, "After the officers talked to me, they gave me a statement and told me to sign it. I signed it. I did not read it because I cannot read. I felt pressured to point at him," unquote. Was there police coercion in Davis's case? The DA certainly thought so and was quoted as saying, "Oh, well, they were probably coerced by the defense too, so
that balances it out, and we should still kill him. Think about that. What power of coercion does the defense possess? Handcuffs? Threats? Jail cells? Criminal charges? Death sentences? That any prosecutor can say something so dopey is, well, nuts. The Troy Davis movement amassed almost 1 million signatures on petitions. Remarkable. But signatures on paper or online aren't people in the streets. If 1 million people were on the march, maybe, maybe he would be alive. Maybe. The limits of the law, blockades imposed in part, ironically, by a former constitutional professor who came to be seen as the first black president, I speak here of Bill Clinton, also denied Troy Davis true redress. Troy Davis's family and supporters brought much to the anti-death penalty movement. I hope they're not too disheartened to continue the struggle. Such struggle will ensure that Troy Davis will not be forgotten. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You have been listening to an event called I Am Troy Davis. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. I'm Stephanie Guy. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs on kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineer, Danielle Parks. Good night.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the third annual What the Festival, June 20th through 23rd in Duver, Oregon. What the Festival is an annual electronics festival which this year features the Glitch Mob, Washed Out, Nightmares on Wax, and more. There will also be a hookah lounge, relaxation huts, and the largest disco ball